Well, it's good to have you here today and to have some guests with us, and we're just delighted that the Lord has made us a family, a church family, and it's a wonderful thing. I forgot an announcement. I've been trying to forget this announcement for quite a while. A friend of mine is a professor at Urbana Seminary, and he met me for lunch about a month ago. And he asked me if I would write and then play a short play, so play a play, about Martin Luther. And I agreed to that. And so I'm going to be doing that play on October 24th in Champaign. There's a family brewery. It's called Riggs Brewing. Anybody know that? Kyle, you know that very well. You don't know it. Kyle, you can admit it. No, you don't know it very well. Okay. Kyle and Micah. Micah, Riggs Brewing? Okay. Oh, sure. You guys. Anyway. So here's what the deal is going to be. I'm going to be Martin Luther, and I'm supposed to talk about my conversion experience, which I'm excited to talk about that for him. But then I'm supposed to talk about whatever led him to write hymns. And then at the end of that, we're all going to sing, whoever comes is going to sing A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, which of course is his most famous hymn and a wonderful hymn of faith. So if you don't have anything else on that night, October 24th. So that'll be good. All right. I have... I understand an unusual heritage. I'm sure it's different than anyone else's in here, in that on the Barry side, Keith has heard it before, so he's out of here. On the Barry side, my dad was one of 12, and my grandpa was one of 18. And my grandpa, Jesse Patton was named after him. He doesn't realize that, but... My grandpa Jesse had the most unusual life, and I somehow have always appreciated that, and I'm grateful that I have. And so my first thought about this is just the proverb, despise not small beginnings. Despise not small beginnings. And that was something that when I started my business, was always in my head too, that we started as humbly as anyone ever could, and then we built the business, and it was a wonderful thing. My grandpa was single. He was 23, and he, to keep body and soul together, was a trapper. And he trapped, amongst other things, the Holston River in Virginia. Now, friends, if you like Mike Connolly, a beautiful trout stream, you would like the Holston River. It's a fabulous, beautiful river. And my grandpa walked that river and trapped it. One day when he was walking the river, there was a young girl outside hanging clothes. And she caught his eye. He was... the ultimately shy man. He was a very shy man. That's probably why at 23 he had no connections. That's kind of old for back then. But he thought this girl was really cute, and she was. And she was to become my grandma. She was 16. And he was doing his traps there, and she was right there, and he got the courage, and you guys know what I'm talking about when you just have to get the courage. He got the courage to ask her if she would come to a church box social. Now, do you know what that is? Yeah. So the ladies would pack a box, a picnic lunch, and they would bring it. So he's inviting her to make a meal and bring it, which is, I think is a wonderful way to go. But she did. She was an orphan. She was working for a family, and they were desperately poor, both of them. Well, they fell in love like this, and the rest is history. In fact, I think Herbert, my oldest uncle, was born while she was yet 16. So they got married right away, and they had a baby 9 months later. Let's just make that clear. Okay? And I was able to kind of partake of this unusual heritage as a kid because when I was born, my grandpa was 83, and he was still trapping. And so as I'm a little boy, and you go to their house, you would see skins hanging there. He skinned everything, and they were hanging there. And then the other thing you did was gather herbs, and potions were made from, ginseng was one, golden seal was one, and echinacea was one, and these things you might even see in the store today, he was gathering and selling, and gathering pollens and so on. He never had another kind of job his whole life. This is what he did. This is how he raised 12 kids. And so I grew up with an affinity for trapping, and I know Keith has been a trapper, and it never really bothered me. My brother was a trapper, and that didn't bother me. But let me tell you something. The first time I ever killed an animal, and I can remember it, with a gun, it bothered me. I couldn't act like it bothered me, because that would be to give up my macho image at age 8. But I was with my neighbor, and I shot a rabbit, and when we secured that rabbit and I saw what had happened to that rabbit and I understood that I was the cause of that, there was something deep down inside me that just kind of shook. Now, I'll tell you, I got over that and I hunted and hunted and I would still hunt. But all of this to say, there is, I think, in mankind a connection to the animal kingdom that we shouldn't just dismiss. If you get Netflix, there's a show called The Great Wild North. Anyone ever see that? It's fabulous. It's about a group of people who live all over the Yukon and Alaska. They're not neighbors with anybody. And they're trappers. And it's how they make their living is trapping these days. And on that show, there's a thing that is common that is not scripted. But what is common is they will trap, let's say, a lynx. And you know what a lynx is? It's a fabulously beautiful cat. Larger than a bobcat, smaller than a mountain lion, has unique ears, huge paws. It's very beautiful. Its coat is worth $1,000. So they will trap lynx. When they trap a lynx or a wolverine or a marten or whatever, almost without fail, they pause and they thank the animal. And I think this is in keeping with a culture that these people grew up in where these animals are viewed to be giving their lives for the trapper. And so they'll be thrilled to have this catch because it's how they make their living. But when they take the animal out of the snare, because that's what they use mostly are snares, they'll just pause and they'll say, "Thank you for your life. Thank you for giving me your life." And I'm very moved by that. I think that shows a humility that's important and necessary. And I also think now I understand where that comes from. I think it comes from Genesis 9. And we're going to read that together today. We're going to reread some of what we read last week, but we're going to get more into it. So you can put my slide up, Micah. It's not much of a slide, but there it is. Yeah, we'll get to that. So please, Genesis 9. Start with verse 1. And God blessed Noah and his sons. Now, wait a minute. Haven't we heard that before? We heard that in Genesis 1, 28. Here, I'll read it for you. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over all of creation, essentially. Chapter 9, and God blessed Noah and his sons, and said to them, be fruitful, and multiply, and fill the earth. Very similar command of God, a very similar dominion statement, but here's where there is a difference. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand there they are delivered. Friends, in Genesis 1, God says to Adam and Eve, have dominion over creation. And that word dominion is just so critical in all this. It doesn't mean dominate. It doesn't mean control. I think it means shepherd. It means to relate to, understand and provide for. It means stewardship. And here's an important thing. Up through the flood, I could not find any evidence where God said to man, I want you to eat meat. I don't know that it's there, and if you can find it and show me, then good for you. But I can't find it. I think that man, from the beginning, ate fruits and vegetables, and that was very sufficient and very delicious. And I don't think until after the flood he ate meat. Now, why would there be fear and dread in the animal kingdom for mankind? Because now the rules have changed. Now God has given the okay for man to harvest and eat meat. Verse 3, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. So can you see here the kind of the subtle change that God is making with the people? That they need to understand now that this meat is good for them. And it will be a nutrient to them. But that's not the end of it. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. And so we know, and in Leviticus especially, we're told how the blood is the metaphorical symbol, but really it's more than that. It's the symbol of life. Blood is the symbol of life. And isn't it interesting how God has created us? That we have this pump, and this pump is continually, all the time in our lives, pushing this blood through us, and new life is coming through that blood. So this is so accurate. They're not to eat blood. Very significant. And for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. Now, what's your lifeblood? If you lose your life to another man, God will require a reckoning. And the reckoning will be the life of that man. So rules have changed. Rules have changed. However, there has been the situation with Cain and Abel that we know about. Now, God did not require Cain's blood, did he? But he did curse him. He cursed him, but at this point, the rules have changed. From every beast I will require it, and from man, from his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. And God is also saying, from every beast I will require it. So this means that there are beasts that can kill people. Now, Tate and Will and Fuzzy are on their way to Canada right now. And they're going to, this week, camp out in a different place in a national park up there every night. And I'm very jealous. Now, I would be staying in the local Motel 6 if I was with them, but there isn't one. But they're going to have a good time. And here's what's so funny, and Keith, you'll appreciate this. I said to them when I was with them, what are you going to do if there's a bear? And Tate says, oh, we found out there aren't any grizzly bears there. I said, what? Yeah, I know there's no grizzly bears there, but what about a big old black bear? Oh, we're not worried about them. You remember what Keith says. Keith wants to have a standoff with a bear, don't you, Keith? Yeah, there's a part of you that does. The Genesis 9 part of you wants a standoff with a bear. And so we said you need to have Keith on this trip because he'll go find a bear and have a standoff. And they were like, oh, poo-pooing this idea of a bear. Well, they're just going to go to an island here and a forest there and down a lake here, and they're going to set up a campsite. Friends, there are bears. And if they don't secure their food, they're going to find out that there are bears. I hope they suspend their food or they'll be suspended. Their wives are here. What? No, I'm not freaking. Am I freaking you out, Chelsea? Okay. Well, pray for them. Pray for them, please. I wasn't sensitive to that, Brandy. Okay. My conscience. That's good. Verse 6 teaches us something that I think we experienced with this Las Vegas tragedy. Why is it painful? Why does it hurt? Why do we suffer when man's life is taken and the ones who are taken are innocent of any reason to be killed? And that's what happened horribly. Look at verse 6. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Why? For God made man in his own image. That line, which we heard before, didn't we? That man is made uniquely in all of creation because he is the image bearer. And when we dedicate a child here, we do so with this understanding that this little baby, this new baby, this Seth, this Judah, this John Edward, all these little babies, all boys lately, by the way, interestingly. The image of God is just in and through them. They are made in God's image. Yesterday, well, we kept Calvin last night, and that's always a great joy for us, but it's always also filled with surprises. And Sue and I were on a walk with Calvin last night and just going along, and he says, Baba, how does God make babies? Yeah, you told him to ask me that? And so I answered it. I stopped our walk and I said, well, Cal, and I went through this careful description of how God makes babies. And I felt like it was adequate. Mom, did you feel like it was adequate? And then he's like, he's okay with it. And he says, but how do they get the seed in there? And I said, well, every little girl that's born already has, and this is true, has the capacity for the children that she's going to have in a very minute way, but it's true. And then God just has these ways of bringing these things together. But you know, female, male, image bearers unite, image bearers born, and we carry on. Of course, at this time, the world is devoid of anybody except who is on the ark. And so the Lord says in verse 7, and you be fruitful and multiply, teem on the earth and multiply in it. So young couples, this has never changed. Don't shake your heads at me. I just want to make sure you're teaming. Define teaming however you want. Say, wife, we need to team. And the wife could say, husband, we shall team. And that can be whatever you cause it to be. But it does suggest that life is an exciting motion of action and movement, and in every way here, God is saying, you carry a picture of me with you. And that picture now, with this change of things, is going to cause the animal kingdom to fear you. Now, I've said this before. I really believe this, and I'm not the only person who's ever believed this. But I've only come to this since I've been a pastor and studied this. And what I believe is made very clear in Romans 8. In Romans 8, Paul says, all creation is groaning. Now, what does that mean? All creation is groaning, looking for something. And what is it looking for? It's looking for redemption. There is a silent or quiet but continual strain of understanding in creation that life is precious and that there is coming redemption. Now, I can see this so clearly when a friend of mine or even our own family loses a pet. Because that pet has become part of the family. You pet lovers know that what I'm saying is true. The pet has become a part of the family. And to just dismiss that as if it doesn't matter is cowardly. I think the thing that we as Christians should do is take that on with sensitivity and love, and even with hope. And the hope is that that pet is just a part of this enormous picture of the animal kingdom and all creation crying out, groaning, looking for eternal life. I really believe that. And I really believe that it's probable that the loves of this life will be known again. And one of the reasons I believe that is because of what I think the world was like before the flood. What was the world like in Eden before the fall. And that's really the key thing here. Do you remember that the Lord said to Adam, I'm going to give you a rare privilege here. And the rare privilege is you get to name the animals. Seriously, friends, how fun would that be? How amazing would that be to say, look at you, Mr. Hippopotamus, which is a perfect name for them, by the way, to name these animals. Adam did that. Because, you know, I think the animals understood their names. Uh-oh, we got to get rid of this guy now. We've got to find that new pastor. No, I think that animals understood their names. And I think that the relationship in the animal kingdom and between man and the animal kingdom was not tarnished yet. Was not tarnished. Before the fall, I think it was beautiful. I think it was a beautiful, look at all of God's creation. Look how they all mesh and fit and so on. But that all changed, didn't it? That all changed here in chapter 9. Then God said to Noah, verse 8, and to his sons with him, behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you. And here's the key. And with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. What does that mean? That means God has made a covenant with the beasts of the earth. Do you see that? Does that matter? I think it does matter because God says it matters. And the covenant is you need to understand, beasts of the earth, that you're not throwaway, that you're not meaningless, that your life has no meaning. When I watch these trappers, these are tough guys, one woman. When I watch these people do their work, there's something deep down inside me that says, well, I asked Sue this, and we had about a two-second conversation. I said, what would have happened if we would have decided early on in our marriage to go live in the Yukon and be trappers? I asked that question. And I think the answer showed me that I would have done that alone, probably. But I wanted it to lead to a discussion of what do children learn when they grow up in that kind of world? And how is that distinct from what they learn here? Well, of course, I think that we are people of community. We need community, and we're not to live isolated. And so that's one thing. But I also think that it's a great blessing when children grow up understanding how life and nature work. And I think that's a challenge to all of us as parents and grandparents, that we take our children and we try to very gently introduce them to life that just teems around us. I think that's very important. Verse 11, I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. And this is the whole rainbow thing that we talked about last week. Okay, a beautiful thing. And then we read last week about how Peter says, don't fret the flood. It's not going to happen again. But note this, people are going to forget the flood, and they're not going to believe in God's judgment on the earth. And God will judge the earth, and he'll judge it with fire. And so we read that. That's not what we're talking about today. But that's very much a part of this. So let's go down to verse 18. The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then there's a parenthetical expression. Ham was the father of Canaan. Let's just pause for a second here. Some of you will remember that I'd say 8 or 9 years ago, I wrote a document that I gave to the church as a Christmas present, which was my own theology of Genesis. And then I inserted stories from my own life. And I invite you to read it. I think it's worth reading. If you have it, if you don't have it, it was a short print job and there are no more. In that document, I have 7 categories that all start with the letter C that I say are thematic in Genesis. One of those categories is covenant. That we see covenant from the beginning to the end. And so we talk about all those covenants. Another one is chaos. We see chaos from verse 2 of the book through the end. Different examples of chaos. But yet another one is Canaan. Canaan. And this is, I believe, our introduction to Canaan. And throughout the book of Genesis, we have fathers telling their sons not to marry Canaanite women. We have that, don't we? We have sons marrying Canaanite women. We have I'm not going to say the curse of the Canaanites, but as much as the reality of the Canaanites entering into the life of God's chosen people. And I spent a wonderful time this week studying all this, and I just think it's a fascinating consideration that the Canaanites were the children of Ham. And that if you were to look at the different maps that people have created, which is, okay, now where did Ham go, and where did Shem go, and where did Japheth go? They're all similar in this, that Ham went to Africa. That Shem dominated the Middle East. And do you know what word comes from Shem? Semite. The Semites are the children of Shem. Who are the Semites? The Hebrew children and Ishmael's children. They are the Shemites. And then here's the interesting thing, and I think I say this in the program. If I don't, I said it somewhere. I believe that since Harvey's not here today, and Trey is not here today, I think I can say that everyone who is here today is related to Japheth. Japheth is our great, 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 great grandfather. And that Japheth is the person who fathered Europe, Northern Europe, Eastern Europe, into the Russia whole thing, and the whole Gog and Magog and Gomer areas, those are Japheth. Okay? And in the Bible, that has strong meaning. It is a fascinating thing to consider. If you're interested in this, there are many, many good websites that deal with this. So, but this is Canaan. Now let's see what the deal is. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the people of the whole earth were dispersed. So Moses is certain as to how the earth came about, and he's also certain how the new earth after the flood came about, and how the earth was peopled. And it was peopled from Noah's sons. Noah began to be a man of the soil. I don't know what he was before. But he apparently decided to become an expert in raising grapes. And he planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. You see the picture behind me? This is what we have. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Now, there is more in that than I can understand. But just at my shallow level of understanding here, this is disrespectful. This is just patently disrespectful. This is, hey, you ought to see Dad, he's drunk and he's naked. Enjoy it. Because it's not enjoyable. And Noah didn't want his nakedness uncovered. And so we have here several things working together to cause a problem. Ham, instead of doing the right thing, and the right thing would have been to immediately cover his sleeping drunk father, Ham is trying to make a way, and in fact an evil way, with his siblings. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. I'm impressed. I'm impressed when people will choose the right over the wrong, will choose the more difficult over the easy when the easy is evil. I'm impressed with these two guys because their respect for their father was what they understood God required of them. And they deliver here by caring for their father. Their faces were turned backward and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Okay, this story you see pictured here. Those who have studied this greatly come up with some conclusions that I think are appropriate. And one is that this event happened some good time, you know, several years, probably many years, 20 to 30 years after the flood has subsided. And there are several reasons, but one being that the vineyard had to grow, it had to produce, it takes time to make wine, and all these things. Also, I think it's intimated here by Moses that Canaan is alive at this time. That Moses wants the children of Israel to understand that this Canaanite phenomenon that they are surrounded by over and over and warring with over and over is a real thing from a real person. And this person was Ham's son. And Noah says, because of what you have done, your offspring are not going to prosper. I was reading about the three regions that archaeologists and anthropologists assign to these three sons. And I find this is interesting, that not all of these guys well, you would necessarily say are Christians who are doing this, but they're saying there are these three strains. There are these three strains. One is African, one is Middle Eastern, and one is European. And that's who we come from. And that Africa, of all these places, is still the most primitive. Still very primitive in some ways, and has always been very primitive. And so some of these guys say, this is in keeping with Noah's curse. I don't know. I do know this, that if we just stay within the Bible and we watch from this point on, we're going to see that the Canaanites are a problem. Now, here's also a wonderful thing. We're also going to see that Jesus is descended from Canaanites. Do we know that? Do we know that when we look at a genealogy of Jesus, we see God reaching in to peoples outside the chosen people, and they're part of the heritage of Jesus of Nazareth? How about our wonderful sister Ruth? Was she an Israeli? No, she was a Moabite, a Canaanite. Was she wonderful? Believe it, she was. Throughout the Old Testament, Canaan is both trouble, but by God's hand at particular times, it becomes a resource of blessing. Okay? Japheth is in this statement of Noah is to be enlarged. Japheth's region, according to anthropologists, this is really crazy interesting, includes the Western Hemisphere, where we live. And in this study, that several different people say this, that it's just, and so tomorrow's Columbus Day, even though it's not the right day. But we all understand that Columbus didn't discover America. Sue declares that the Norwegians did, and there's some support for that. But these Japheth lovers say no. Who was the first? The first were the sons of Japheth. And how did they get there? So these guys are historians and specialists in people groups. And they say that Japheth's sons, grandsons, whomever, landed on the eastern part of the Western Hemisphere. And they position it pretty close to the equator. And then more landed in North America. See, we're always taught something in school, and that is that the Native Americans all came through the land bridge of the Bering Sea. Some did. But do you know that there's a DNA difference between the Western tribes and the Eastern tribes? The Eastern tribes came from somewhere else. And the assertion is they're the children of Japheth. Now, this is fascinating. This is really something. Noah takes very seriously the disrespect he's shown. My final point today is, and what does this mean for us? You know, what does this whole story mean for us? We live in a culture, friends, here in the United States of America that has lost respect. It's lost respect for parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and teachers and neighbors and so on. And it's lost respect because we have lost respect. And so we look at this story and say, now, where would we be in this thing if we saw our father naked and he was wiped out by drunkenness? Would we invite in our brothers, or would we cover his nakedness? I think that we as Christians have so much to learn from Genesis 1 through 11. And when we're all done with this series, and we're getting near that, we're going to have a review of these things. And that one of the things we must learn in order to live the most blessed life is to respect animals as they are given to us. Respect all of creation, because all of creation is included in this and is to be shepherded. And to respect the human body. And not in a tantalizing way, but in a sacred way. And this would be a revolution. And this seems to me to be where the enemy attacks us readily. It's a tough thing. But it's never so tough that it can't be healed. Healed by mercy, healed by grace. All of this brokenness that we read about, remember what it said that when Jesus was dead, he went and preached to the captives. Friends, there are many Bible scholars who believe that Jesus went to the people who lived before the flood and preached the gospel to them. What a thing. We don't know. But what a thing to consider. He preached to somebody. Amen? Amen. Let's sing, Scott.